Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, May 22nd, 2014. Many topics to cover on tonight's show. The main science topic, I'm going to be talking about a guy named Professor Louis A. Frank, who passed away May 16th, 2014, this past week in Iowa. He was at the University of Iowa for many years, and he was originally part of the Van Allen team that discovered, Professor Van Allen, who was also at Iowa, discovered the Van Allen belt. So this guy goes way back. One of his primary contributions, although he had many, many during his life, was seeing the water areas, the water regions up in the upper ionosphere of Earth. And so that's a very interesting story I'll be talking about. I'll be talking about his life work point by point, and that would take about 10, 20 shows just in itself, but I'll try and summarize it tonight. Other than that, a few quick announcements. In the primaries this last week, Oregon, this in from a listener, thank you for sending these in. And by the way, people, when you see something interesting out there that correlates with topics that I cover on this show, please feel free to send it in. I really appreciate listener mail because I cannot be out there every place searching the internet. But this in from a listener, Oregon, two counties, Jackson County and Josephine counties in the state of Oregon, passed a no GMO law. In other words, banning GMO. But what's interesting is that the state of Oregon has passed a law preventing counties from putting non-GMO or GMO ban topics on the ballot. Can you imagine the state of Oregon telling counties that they cannot pass GMO bans on a countywide basis, which of course is illegal, because in the state constitution, the first thing it says is it gets its power that directs the counties to basically operate autonomously. And so a totally illegal law that's been passed by Oregon. But these two counties had their valid referendum before the state ban. So they voted, and it was just a landslide vote allowing the farmers to exist free of GMO. And Monsanto, DuPont, the other biggies in agribusiness put in tons of money in advertising, as they did in California, et cetera. And, but to no avail, the population voted them out. And it's very interesting because now they have to recognize that Monsanto is involved in chemtrail spraying. So that means that above, the airspace above those counties has to be free from GMO type of activity. This is very interesting because if they spray in the next county, obviously it can blow into their county. So this gets interesting. And just to give you an idea, other places that have provided such bans, the state, let me just go through these. I'll read here. Counties in Oregon, other counties include Santa Cruz County, Trinity County, Marin County, Mendocino County in California, San Juan County in Washington State, and also the Big Island of Hawaii and Oahu have banned GMO taro and coffee specifically. The state of Vermont has passed a law which mandates that all GMO foods sold in the state must be labeled. And so at any rate, obviously the federal government has failed in protecting the public. In most cases, the states have failed, so the counties are taking this up. I talked about this a number of weeks ago on my show, and so let me see if I can find some websites here that they talk about. Yeah, I don't see any web pages here, but I'm sure if you search on the internet, you will find a lot of references to those issues. another listener email wrote in and said that he had measured, he's got barometric measuring equipment, barometric pressure, which is the barometer reading tells you the atmospheric pressure at ground level, where you are. And so anyway, he lived in the path of many of these storms that came through a couple weeks ago, and he said that the barometric pressure did not drop. Now, when you have a storm system, the typical, it's very standard for the barometric pressure to drop. And he read the barometric pressure during the height of these storms to be the same as a bright sunny day, which indicates that it's a very interesting result, something that I'm doing some more research into, but something that letting people aware, if there's a big storm and you think it's manipulated, look at your barometer, because any wall barometer will do. Typically, on a very serious storm, the barometer could drop down around 27 or somewhere in that range, and that is indicative of a low pressure cell, which is at the center of the storm system, and that is caused by the fact that the upwelling of ionic charge ions, the air around ground level is ionized because of the electricity that's going on, the electrical currents. Those ions come rushing up the column of the storm system, thusly producing a low pressure cell. That's what causes this. It is a result of the electrical discharge between the ground air region and up to the ionosphere. It's the same whether it's a hurricane or a tornado or just a regular thunderstorm system. So this is a natural byproduct of the storm system reacting to the electrical current that's passing down from the ionospheric capacitor that's above. And the air acts as a dielectric, but once that starts flowing, it's an electrical current, and a lot of energy is passing between the ionosphere and the ground level air. So at any rate, if you have a manipulated storm that is being driven by electrical currents from above, typically the satellite lasers are not going to penetrate down to the ground level, and what you get is a storm system. It looks like a storm, but the barometric pressure at ground level remains the same. A super interesting result, and I'm very glad that the listeners sent that in, something that everybody out there should keep in mind. So if you're experiencing storm systems, look at your barometer. Is it dropping down to the 28-27 region, especially for severe storms, or is it sitting up there around 30 or even 31, which would indicate a bright sunny day, which would tell you that the storm overhead is being manipulated? Very interesting. And once again, thanks to listeners who send this in that are tuned to what I'm doing here and are starting to put these pieces together. Great, great input. A truck overturned in New Jersey with 20 million bees aboard. It crashed and opened up the semi-trailer, and the bees got out, I guess most of them, so they had quite a deal managing these bees. But from all I can see, this was not some kind of conspiracy item. It was simply an accident. In fact, it turns out that the county where this took place had some kind of a plan in place to deal with bee issues. And so they were able to mitigate the threat, although a lot of people, the drivers of the truck, were bitten, they say, 50 to 100 times. Can you imagine that, trying to run away from a truck with 20 million bees in it? Good grief. But it does seem a bit suspicious, but no indication in either the reporting or in what happened that it would be some type of Monsanto or other instigated event. Although these days, I'll tell you, it's pretty hard to tell what's going on out there. The real issue with HR, I believe the bill is 2847, comes into effect July 1st. It's called the Compliance Taxation Act, some deal like that. A couple issues this bill, and of course all over the internet has been saying that this will crash the American economy. And that might be a bit of an overstatement, but when you analyze what's going on around the world, the banks around the world are reacting by shutting off the American citizen, the people, American nationals living abroad in foreign countries. It's shutting off their banking services, just telling them it's bank policy or some other excuse. Basically, the people's, U.S. citizens' banks, not only personal, but business banking is being shut down. Now, since the American businessman or traveling businessman is basically going to be unable to function, this is worldwide, the effects. And once again, you have people passing bills, and they think it's going to do some good or bring in some revenue. But the whiplash effect, the unexpected effect, or in other words, in this case, I believe the real intent of this law was to bring an umbrella under any Americans abroad so that when the American dollar collapses and the tax rate goes to 100% to pay off the unbelievable national debt that has accrued already this year, they have raised the debt ceiling, meaning that they've already run out of all the money allotted for this year. They've already run out of it and had to acquire more borrowing from the Federal Reserve European bank system that's operating in this country. So when that system fails, and they had to have this in place soon before July 1st, meaning that they expect the collapse to happen very shortly thereafter, they can reach out into foreign banks and tax American citizens at 100% or a super high percentage and demand that money from foreign banks. Now, you can imagine what kind of a shockwave this sends through the administration of a foreign bank, that all of a sudden they got the U.S. IRS demanding that they send them money in the name of some depositor. Well, depositor, adios amigo. And so anyway, it's obvious that this is having reverberations around the globe and literally just going to shut down economic, any type of international trade. It's just going to shut it down. Also, there's a real estate tax, I understand, 3.7% real estate tax in the United States on any real estate sold. So now the Gov wants a bigger portion than what a realtor makes. And a lot of states have real estate sales tax. Oh, man. This is just going to shut down real estate big time. Anyway, I'm sure you can find a lot more information around the internet on this, but very important to understand. July 1st, put that on your calendar. And by the way, that's why I have a 10% sale on my sales page, on my webpage right now, jmccsci.com. That's seven letters, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. Because I have a 10% sale posted on the major items there because I think this baby's coming down very soon, and I just I don't know after this collapse, whether the entire economy collapses or just this foreign segment. I mean, we're going to have it's going to be a foreign balance of foreign trade issue. I mean, it's just going to be an absolute international disaster. And so it also points to the fact that they're probably doing everything they can do to crash the U.S. dollar so they can usher in the new international monetary system. And, of course, Putin is playing into this because of all the activity in the Ukraine. Putin has now signed a big agreement to deal with energy to China and bypassing the petrodollar. So the U.S. dollar is gonna crash. And people are saying, well, we're going to get back at Russia. Well, no. The United States is extremely weak. They're trying to be the big bully on the block, but you can't be the big bully on the block when your knees are shaking. And so that's exactly what's going on. But understand, in the background, the real background plan of the world bankers Putin is playing right into the hands, and he has no option. That's a chess game. He has no option but to sell his petrol products to other countries away and not use the dollar as a medium of exchange. So it's just very clear. The writing is on the wall. The U.S. economy is going to crash and just drive it into a third world country status. Anyway, that coming July 1st, put that on your calendar, mental calendar. Jupiter's great red spot is disappearing. This is a very interesting issue that over the past number of years. So at any rate, the issue is that the spot, let me get this statistic, was originally, when it was observation and measurements were first started back in the 1800s, the spot was 25,000 miles across. And in recent years, it has been being reduced by about 500 to 600 miles per year in diameter. Right now, it's a mere 10,000 miles across. So it's a fully less than half the diameter of the spot. And of course, the area going as the square of that number of the radius shows that the area has diminished by a factor of about six. And so a tremendous reduction in the area and, of course, the energy of that. I get a kick out of the standard explanation here. What they're saying is that they think that the big storm, the big red spot, eats little spots that are around it, and that's where it gets its energy from. Now, this is fairy tale science at its best. How can the great red spot eat little spots and get energy? And they're saying, well, the great red spot must be eating fewer little spots, and therefore that's why it's shrinking. Okay, so that's the fairy tale science that comes out of standard science. Here's what's really going on. Now, let's compare the great red spot of Jupiter. Let's compare it to a hurricane system on Earth. A hurricane develops in the Atlantic. We have storm systems that come across the central equatorial region of Africa, tremendous thunderstorms, especially during those months around August, July, August, September. That's the height of the thunderstorm season, the rainy season in Central Africa. Okay, so those storms roll off of that nub off of Western Africa out into the Atlantic, where they start. Now, that electrical connection to the ionosphere is all of a sudden it was able to send the lightning bolts into the ground as those big storm systems moved across Central Africa. But now as it gets out over the ocean, the ocean is not as accepting of the electrical discharges. So what happens is the air ionizes around the surface of the ocean, and that air, ionized air, starts to move up, and it forms a central column. And as the air moves upward, it spirals. It goes into a cyclonic storm pattern, moving and spiraling up, and that's what eventually forms the eye of the hurricane, and that's what sustains the hurricane. Jupiter's great red spot is clearly such an animal. It is a hurricane. Now let's examine what happens to the hurricane on Earth. It moves across the Atlantic. It may spin off into the North Atlantic and go away. Eventually, the storm system may end up in England or the Canary Islands or Western Europe, in Spain, Portugal. But what sometimes happens is that storm moves across over to the United States or Mexico, etc., or South America sometimes, or the Caribbean Islands, whatever. In it, that central portion now, that electricity has a ground where it can start grounding out that electrical current. So the hurricane actually loses energy, and in that point it starts to dump water. It starts to dump its load of water, and so you get on the leading edge, you get a tremendous amount of electrical activity and tornadoes. on the leading edge of a hurricane as it passes into land. And so what that's doing is starting to discharge that electrical current that's coming from the ionosphere that's been driving the hurricane. And by the way, that's what satellite lasers do when they start to manipulate and control hurricanes, like Hurricane Katrina. They put that laser beam right down in the corner of the eye, and they can drag that baby around like a bull with a ring in its nose. And we've seen this where hurricanes will come out, and they'll actually go up and do a loop-de-loop around out in the Atlantic and come in. They guided Hurricane Katrina down south of Florida, over into the center of the Gulf, and then it all of a sudden turned 90 degrees and made a beeline due north to New Orleans. And they already knew when that thing was out in the Atlantic, it was going to New Orleans. The newspapers were even reporting it, Hurricane Katrina to hit New Orleans. You know, that's absolutely impossible to make such a prediction unless you know that your buddy over there has got his hand on the joystick and running the satellite laser. So at any rate, let's go back to Jupiter, the Great Red Spot. And the Great Red Spot now does not have any land mass underneath it, or an ocean land mass interface, so to speak. So that keeps going around and around and around without anything to stop it. So if we didn't have a land mass around in the central equatorial part of Earth, we could have hurricanes that keep going and going and going, kind of like the Ever-Ready Rabbit. So, but we have land masses, and when they hit those land masses, that's where they electrically short out. Jupiter's Great Red Spot does not have that. Now, the question, why does Jupiter's Great Red Spot diminish in size? What's going on there? Well, the real reason for this is because the solar electrical activity is way down, and we're seeing that on Earth here. We're seeing that in the actual cooling of Earth. The tremendous cold winters we've had in the past years are an absolute result of the cooling of Earth, simply due to the fact that the solar energy output is diminished. The solar energy spectrum is very strange. We're actually getting more ultraviolet light, and we're getting less of the visible light, so the light part of the energy equation is diminished, and the electrical part, we're not seeing, for example, the comets that we've seen lately are not as vibrant, they're not as powerful as other comets in the past, and so we're just seeing this. There's many ways to see that the solar energy, the electrical solar energy, has been diminished. So at any rate, that is the real reason for the diminishing size of the Great Red Spot of Jupiter. And understand now, it's connecting to the ionosphere. And why is it red? Because it's pulling up that sulfur dioxide, that heavier sulfur dioxide, the chemicals that are deeper down in the atmosphere of Jupiter. It's pulling them up the column, just like a hurricane, and spilling out and over. And so what we're doing is we're looking down the eye of a hurricane on Jupiter with the lower level chemicals being ushered up into the upper level chemicals, which are mainly hydrogen compounds. And so the lighter hydrogen compounds, I should say. So the it's a system that is basically driven by solar energy's electrical energy. Now, if you looked at Jupiter, we also know from satellites going around that Jupiter's Great Red Spot is highly electrical, and it has a lot of magnetic field activity related to it. This is caused by the fact that that is connected to outer space. It's like a long cometary tentacle attached to Jupiter. Just like on Earth, we have long tentacles in outer space that connect, plasma tentacles that connect down to the regions of the upper atmosphere, which then connect down into the severe storm systems down below. So a hurricane will have a commensurate path all the way up to the ionosphere, and then that extends out into space as a plasma sheath that is connecting to our upper atmosphere. Now remember that, because when I talk about Lou Frank in the main science topic of this show, that is something that he physically measured, and that's a whole interesting story. So I'll, but that's the issue with Jupiter's Great Spot. Just a quick political comment here on the Tea Party. My commentary on the Tea Party is that has been thoroughly taken over, homogenized, and blended to have basically what they appear to be controversial issues, but not so much different from the Republican Party that it would make a difference, so the Republicans can easily win. But what the Tea Party does now is it blocks any third-party independent from ever getting in there again. Now, I know there's a lot of Tea Party people down at the basic root level, and they think they're doing a great job, and they are. But what you have to understand, it's been like every other institution that comes along, whether it's MUFON, whether it's no matter what national movement comes along, it's infiltrated, taken over, and then diverted. And that's what's happened to the Tea Party. So all these people working at grassroots level, at the local level, are doing very good work. It may have an effect at your local level, but when you get up to the national level, it's simply there to take the place of any third-party candidate that ever would ever think about running. And it so-called gives all of those people a voice, but really it's, like I say, homogenized and blended and been taken over, and it really, for all future time, will be nothing more than a third party to take up the slack and absorb. Just, there's another great example. I talk about the myth of alternative energy. The wind generators and the solar, whether they're solar engines or heat engines, or whether they're solar panel type installations for commercial power, all of these are a myth of alternative energy, and they're all being subsidized by the big energy contributors like GE and Raytheon and the other companies that build components for these, because the reality is the way wind and solar energy are implemented today, they'll never make a dent in even the smallest part of our energy requirement, and so therefore they are the myth of alternative energy that is constantly being propagated. I talk about this all the time on my show, where the energy projects, like in the North Sea, they have these big metal tubes that they put out there as floats to try and draw energy, change wave energy into usable electrical energy. But when you look at the scale and the cost, and the return on investment, these are government-subsidized projects, you see that only the ones that will never work, that will never make a dent for in reality, only those ones are funded. And anything else is blocked, eaten up, or spit out sideways in the alternative energy field. But anyway, the Green Party, the Tea Party, is my way of seeing this, is just a taken over, diverted effort to keep the people who are working at grass levels from ever having a real third-party candidate. Just a very interesting note, another listener writing in that Antarctica, the land mass of Antarctica, is actually rising, lifting up vertically. Very interesting story, and it's measurable. And it's because the ice pack is sliding off and melting, both at the same time. And so the standard explanation is that this is due to global warming. Of course, the standard Global Warming Act, even though the global climate change people now are claiming that the Earth is cooling. But the global, they use this interchangeably. It depends on who you talk to and what effect they want to have. But it's not due to global warming. The end result is that the land of Antarctica is warm. It's warm because it just a few thousand years ago, it was in a semi-tropical climate or semi-temperate climate. And when the pole shift occurred, when Venus, the comet came by before it became the planet Venus, it produced a pole shift of about 35 degrees. I did surveying down in the Mayan ruins, and I've discovered that if you look at the old city grids of Chichen Itza, Uxmal, and the whole laundry list, Tulum, all of the cities, and you take the old city grids, which they eventually rebuilt on, not knowing that the northeast-southwest lines had changed, you will see that the old city grids produce northeast-south and west lines, the north-south lines that cross in a point in northern Michigan and southern Ontario. That's around the location of the old North Pole. That's why the old Laurentian ice cap was in that region, and it did not extend over into Siberia, which was much more temperate before the pole shift. And so when Venus came by, it was that large gravitational wave which created the pole shift. And so the same thing happened with Antarctica, but the landmass of Antarctica was very warm. And so when the rapid many miles of ice pack built up on it, then it's that ice pack starts sliding off because the land is warm. There are actually rivers underneath the land mass, and the same is true with Greenland, which has a lot of water flowing down underneath it. But at any rate, the land mass of Antarctica is rising up at a measurable rate, but that's why it's reacting, it's rebounding from the relief, the weight loss of the ice pack on top, which is sliding off into the ocean. And by the way, we should be harvesting that water, that fresh water. Earth has about 80 to 90% of Earth's fresh water is locked in Antarctica and Greenland, and right now it's just flowing off into the ocean and being absolutely wasted. So the fact that we are warming up, and there is global warming going on a natural basis, but what's we are losing energy because the solar energy output is lower, but the actual situation with Earth overall is we are about stabilizing after a couple thousand years of warming up. It's a natural warming period after the glaciation that occurred when Earth was encountered the comet Venus, dropped us into basically an ice age, covered the Earth with a lot of water that was in the form that fell and turned into ice packs. Those eventually melted, and now the light is not being reflected. Those reflected light back into outer space, and so that process is coming to an end, that natural cooling process. So the glaciers are melting, the Earth is warming up, and it's actually getting back to normal. So now we're being controlled by the local solar output, is the actual situation. Okay, I'm going to get on with the topic at hand, the main science topic, Professor Lou Frank's work, and I'll be trying to go through many of the things he discovered and clarified in terms of space science, but very involved in the measurement of, for example, the Van Allen belts. As I said at the beginning of the show, he was instrumental. He was part of the team of Dr. Van Allen back in the day when they discovered the Van Allen belts. This was just shortly after World War II. So they sent rockets up, and the actual dating of that was around 1958, the discovery of the Van Allen belts. And, of course, before the Apollo program, and one of the main issues that we deal with today, one of the main questions, is how on Earth, or how in the universe, did the Apollo astronauts fly through the Van Allen belts? And there's all kinds of trickery and after-the-fact explanations for how they did this magical trick. Although the astronauts did not have X-ray or gamma ray detectors on their bodies. The only detectors they had were alpha and beta particle detectors. That was the official Apollo badge, which I'm very familiar with because I studied everything that NASA did when I was in college. We had access to all of the NASA manuals of the entire Apollo space program. So the only type of radiation badge that the Apollo astronauts had were alpha and beta particles. Yet all of the astronauts live happily ever after. But the Russians, who I worked directly with in the mid-1990s, laughed at the Apollo space program. They said, these guys never went to the moon. And they knew they had bigger rockets than we did. They could have easily sent cosmonauts to the moon and come back. They spent far more time in outer space than the Americans. But they did try and send a man to the moon long before the Americans, and the guy came back pretty much French fried. And the reason was is because the radiation in the Van Allen belts, it hits the metal in the spacecraft and it becomes a giant X-ray, giant X-ray source. And so that's why there's a problem with the Van Allen belts. In fact, NASA very coyly has a entire program. It's called Living with a Star. And the entire point of that program, which on which thousands of scientists work today, is how do you get through the Van Allen belts? That's the main question they're trying to answer. Yet they lightly pass this off. And if there was no problem with the Apollo space program, why do they have a program called Living with a Star? If those astronauts in the Apollo program went out, came, landed on the moon, went through the Van Allen belts twice on their way out and their way back, and there was no problem, why does NASA have a program with thousands of physicists and other scientists working, trying to figure out how to get through the Van Allen belts? Well, obviously a contradiction. But Lou Frank, a great physicist from the University of Iowa, was instrumental in, he was on the team with Van Allen when they discovered the Van Allen belts. Okay, I'm just going to read this from the official release upon his death, just so you get an idea, and then we'll talk about some of these particular items. It said, Dr. Frank was professor of physics at the University of Iowa, where he had been a member of the faculty since 1964. His first professional research activities occurred in 1958 when he assisted Professor Van Allen in the calibration of the first U.S. lunar probes, Pioneers 3 and 4, as an undergraduate student. Since then, he had been an experimenter, co-investigator, or principal investigator for instruments on 42 spacecraft. Dr. Frank was the principal investigator for the auroral imaging instruments for the Dynamics Explorer mission that I will talk about in a minute here, and it's plasma instrumentation for the Galileo mission to Jupiter, the U.S. plasma instrumentation for the Japanese Geotail spacecraft, and the camera for visible wavelengths for the polar spacecraft of the International Solar Terrestrial Physics Program. His publications encompass such topics as the first direct measurements of the terrestrial ring current and of the polar cusp, the current systems in Earth's magnetotail, the plasma tori at Jupiter, at Saturn, the global imaging of Earth's auroral zones and atmosphere. His research interests were directed towards magnetospheric plasmas in the vicinity of Earth, wave plasma instabilities, active experiments in the ionosphere, interpretation of auroral images in terms of global convection and current systems, the Jovian magnetosphere, and the relationship with the Galilean satellites, computed tomography, geocoronal hydrogen, comets, and optics. He served on various NASA, et cetera, et cetera. And so anyway, that's a big package of study that he has done. And also, you might notice that it deals with the plasma issues around Earth and some of the other planets like Jupiter, Saturn, etc. Okay, so let me go back. I was at a American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco probably around 1996. Go back farther. This was around 1986. And the issue there was the comets. This was the 1986 American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco. I believe it was the fall meeting. And the topic that I was involved with was the physics of the interaction of the comet the spacecraft ISEE, which they renamed the ICE spacecraft, as they went out and went through the tail of a comet called Giacobini-Zinner. And also in that meeting were test results of the various international spacecraft that went out to visit the comet Halley's. And these were all recent results. But at any rate, at that time, Professor Frank had a concept, and he said they were seeing signatures in some of the other satellite data. They were seeing signatures of splotches of water up in the upper Earth's atmosphere. And the other scientists had written this off as extraneous data, incorrect data, that there was something wrong with the sensors, and just forget about it. Lou Frank was not a person to take this lightly. He said, no, these signatures are real. He was the person who built those experiments, and so he knew his data was real. So he proposed a camera system that went on the ultraviolet observing camera that was to be in a polar orbit around Earth and observe the Earth's auroral zones, etc., in the Earth's upper ionosphere. He had proposed a camera to specifically look for those water images. He was denied. He was denied access of his instrument that he designed. So he went in and he snuck it into the satellite. He had access. He built his detector. He put it on the satellite. And once the satellite was up there, he got his data back and proved to the scientific community that in fact the other images were not false, but they were in fact true. And so the end result was that Earth, if you look at Earth, the upper ionosphere has little splotches of water that are occurring on a constant, just constantly. And so, of course, when this happened, the standard space science and astronomy community came back, first of all, a bit in awe that, first of all, he could sneak an instrument onto a satellite, second of all, retrieve the data, and third, prove them wrong. So at any rate, that was the one of the big comments of background chatter among the scientists at the 1986 American Geophysical Union meeting. And I gave a poster session, where I talked about the real results of the physics of passing a comet through a satellite through a comet tail, which was Giacobini-Zinner. But Lou Frank's information came out at that meeting also. But then Standard Science immediately had to jump up to the plate and give a standard explanation. So even back then, they were using the dirty snowball, saying that this was due to little dirty snowballs, micro dirty snowballs hitting the upper atmosphere. But that explanation did not hold water, because these are relatively large areas of the Earth's upper atmosphere. And of course, what was going on was the same issue as is going on with Jupiter and its great red spot. Earth's upper atmosphere, as these electrical plasma connections occur, just like a comet tail, the Earth's upper atmosphere connects electrically into outer space as they become charged. The water, which is the same major material in a comet tail, comes rushing in. The hydrogen and oxygen come in. They combine as they meet with the Earth's upper atmosphere, and that's where these little water splotches are coming from. So this all makes sense if you understand what's going on in outer space. It's the exact same process that drives the great red spot at Jupiter and causes it to have a good deal of electrical and magnetic activity, the magnetic activity resulting from the electrical currents that occur in that region. So that's a wonderful story about Lou Frank, how he was able to sneak an instrument on a spacecraft that he was told he could not put any instrumentation on. He got it on there, was able to work so that he got the data back through the common data system of the satellite and proved to the professors who denied him access that he was right. A wonderful story. At that meeting, by the way, I was in contact with the team at Goddard that was the solar system plasma physics team. And at that time, I was quite well known amongst those people. I could pick up the phone and call them and talk to them, etc. And that continued up to the point around 1995 when X-rays were discovered in comets. That was a discovery that I had predicted. I got a phone call one day. This was around, I believe, about 1995, and the announcement came out that Hyakutake, a comet that was coming close to Earth, just by accident, they had a graduate student had placed one of the instruments on one of the X-ray detecting satellites that is in outer space the United States had funded, pointed it to the comet and found an extremely hot X-ray signature 30,000 miles to the sunward side of the nucleus of comet Hyakutake. And by the way, that's included in my, the data from that is included in my book on comets, my ebook. But at any rate, the issue with X-rays at comets, like I said, I predicted that. I called up the people I knew at Goddard, and I said, this is something I predicted, and I sent all the information. Within a couple of months, they already had their PAT explanation, their replacement explanation, and decided never to reference my material. It's a bone of contention that goes on to this day, and a guy named Kerry Liss got the credit for that discovery. Although it was a physics discovery with an instrument, they didn't recognize my prediction, which is standard fare, but you have to understand, those people work for the man. And they do what they're told to do, and if they're told not to reference something, they don't reference it, or their future is going to be short-lived. At any rate, another little story from history there. But back to Lou Frank, I want to talk about some of the physics that he did here. Now let's talk about the plasma tori at Jupiter and at Saturn. Now Jupiter and Saturn both have what is called a tori, and it's a physical, looks like a donut ring around Jupiter. It's at the same location as the moon Io, and it's part of what you might call the elongated tail of Io. In other words, Io is acting as a comet in the plasma environment of Jupiter. Now let's understand also that Jupiter and Saturn are acting as small stars. One of the primary results of the Voyager spacecraft that went by Jupiter and Saturn is they both observed at both planets, Jupiter and Saturn, they observed the same type of solar wind coming up from the planetary surface as the Sun exhibits. It's a plasma fusion-based wind. But that data was swept under the rug. It's still visible in the science articles that came out of the Voyager flybys of Jupiter and Saturn. But Jupiter has a lesser wind than Saturn, which is very interesting because Saturn is a smaller planet, if you want to call it that. It's really a little star. But Saturn is much more active, which once again doesn't make much sense. Saturn puts out far more energy than Jupiter for its size. Jupiter puts out between 2 and 3 times the amount of energy that it receives from the Sun. So how can that happen? It turns out that Jupiter and Saturn support fusion in their upper atmospheres. These fusion reactions are supported by strong electrical discharges. I talked last week and the week before about solar conditions and how the fusion in the atmosphere of the Sun is caused by electrical discharge, electrical storms in the atmosphere. And this is caused by something called the pinch effect. When the lightning bolts wind down through the atmosphere and they have a very abrupt change of direction in the electrical current, in that bend is where the magnetic fields become high enough to create the pressures that are needed to kick off the fusion reactions. This is also happening in the atmospheres of Jupiter and Saturn. So at any rate, the torus, this creates a proton wind that comes off the surface of both Jupiter and Saturn, and these were measured. But that data has been swept under the rug because they don't want to talk about it. But that proton wind is the same thing that causes comets in the solar environment, to causes comets to discharge the solar capacitor. It's the same thing that causes the moons around Jupiter to discharge the Jupiter fusion-based capacitor. Thus, Io is highly charged, and it's drawing in tail material, primarily sulfur dioxide, because that's the primary chemical in the region of Jupiter. That's why Jupiter is red. That's why the Great Red Spot is red. And the end result is there is an electrical discharge continually between the moon Io and the planet Jupiter. Now, all of this is understandable in terms of my plasma discharge comet model. So the moon Io is actually acting as a comet. Now, in standard science, they have it completely backwards. They're saying that a magnetic field of Jupiter creates a electrical current. Well, this is absurd because magnetic fields follow from electric currents, not vice versa. If you have a generator, like an electrical generator, you need both a conductor, which is a closed conductor like a metal wire, and you need permanent magnets that move and create currents to flow in that solid conductor. In the plasma environment of outer space, you don't have those conditions, so there's no way that a magnetic field is going to continually drive current between a planet and a moon when they claim that those planets and moons are electrically neutral. You see the absolute string of contradictions here, but at any rate, Lou Frank worked on the instrumentation on Galileo spacecraft, which was the mission to Jupiter, and the other missions like that. It also they measured those same plasma toroids at Saturn. And now recently it's been shown that the rings of Saturn rain down onto the upper surface of Saturn. Rain water, literally, into the upper surface of the atmosphere of Saturn. But now standard science says that the rings of Saturn formed 4.5 billion years ago as part of the planetary formation. Well, how can that be true when, in fact, the rings are constantly spiraling inward? In fact, it's a misnomer to call the rings a ring system, because you can see the rings spiral in, kind of like an old vinyl record. Remember the old vinyl records? The needle went on the outside, and as it played, it slowly worked its way from the outside to the inside of the record. And so it was like a slow spiral inwards, and the rings of Saturn are exactly the same. They are cut in space by moons that move around within the ring system and divide the ring system, so that does give you the illusion that they're rings and connecting rings, circular rings around the planet, but the reality is that that's not the case at all. They are continually spiraling in, and when they get in close to the planet, they rain down on the planet. So you need a continual source of ring material, which is primarily water, raining down through that ring system and coming from outside. So the Saturn ring system is a dynamic system, and it's based on, once again, the idea that Saturn is in the solar plasma environment, discharging the solar capacitor. As that water rains in, it is caught up in the magnetic field of Saturn. As the ions come in, they're ionized by solar radiation, they start to spin around, just like the Van Allen belts are the same issue around Earth. You have protons and electrons coming in from the solar wind, and they get trapped in the magnetic field of Earth. They're simply high-energy particles trapped in the magnetic field of Earth. That's what the Van Allen belts are. Jupiter and Saturn have similar belts. They're just a bit more visible because in Earth's Van Allen belts, we're primarily dealing with protons and electrons, which are not particularly visible. But in the environment around Jupiter and Saturn, they're trapping ions such as the sulfur dioxide around Jupiter, which is highly visible. So you can actually see the rings. You can also see the rings around, for example, the Neptune rings, the Uranus rings. You can see those. They're visible through camera work. You can see stars occulting those rings. or the rings occulting the stars, I should say, where they block the light from stars. So the actual way that many rings have been discovered in the solar system is when astronomers are looking with a telescope and the stars pass by those rings, and all of a sudden their light drops for just a second, and then it drops, then it rises back to normal. So they know there's a ring there. There are visible consequences of those rings being there. But at any rate, Lou Frank had a lot to do with that. He had was instrumental in putting instruments on spacecraft that viewed the auroras. Right now, you can go, for example, on many of the websites. You can go, for example, to the SOHO website or the GEO satellite websites. And you can see the auroras on the South Pole of Earth and the North Pole of Earth. You can see them constantly. They look like a donut-shaped ring of auroral activity. This is ultraviolet light. Lou Frank had a lot to do with those cameras, the design of those cameras, so that you can visibly see, you convert the ultraviolet light to a visible light in your photos, and you can actually watch and see the auroral bands. As the solar storms erupt, those bands get bigger, and when they expand far out of the polar region down into, say, the North American continent or down into Russia, some have extended as far down as Texas, you can see that in the cameras that were designed by Lou Frank. So a tremendous amount of valuable, he was very concentrated on data, and you might understand that this data was all dealing with the plasma in high energy auroral regions of Earth, the electrical currents, the tori, the ring currents, the Van Allen belts. You can see where this man's work was throughout his lifetime. The unfortunate part is he, like many scientists, were strapped by the dominant political theme that space is electrically neutral. Now, something happened back in the early days of plasma physics where you had Hans Alvin from the European contingency and you had the Chapman from the American side. Chapman was the sponsor, so to speak, of neutral outer space physics, that everything we saw was due to magnetic effects, whereas the Hans Alvin, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics, when he gave his speech in physics to accept the Nobel Prize, he basically said there's a political war going on here, and he was trying to emphasize the fact that understanding of plasmas electrically in outer space was important, that understanding where these electrical currents came from. That's where my work came in. And, of course, in the United States, everything having to do with the basis of my work and the visibility of my work has been blocked because I am absolutely on the correct path in explaining all of the data that you see from these satellites. I'm out of time. Remember to go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. Remember, there's a sale going on, 10% sale. You also get free books with any water filter purchase. And I'm out of time. We'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanney, the webpage jmccsci.com. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.